Psalm 131 and verse number 1. This is a psalm of ascent written by David. Lord, my heart is not haughty, nor my eyes lofty or lifted up. Neither do I concern myself in great matters or in things too high for me. Surely I have calmed and quieted myself. As a child that is weaned of his mother, my soul is even as a weaned child. Let Israel hope in the Lord, from henceforth, from now and forever. I title the message this morning, Still Learning, lest anyone think that what I have experienced is finished, and that I've learned everything that I need to learn. And I'm now ready to impart to you wisdom from a trial. No, that's not the case at all this morning. I'm still in the middle of this. I'm still struggling. I'm still taking things not day by day, but moment by moment. Still, this morning, I am coming to worship with you, our God, together, desiring to learn what God wants me to learn in this season of my life. I read Psalm 131, and honestly, I want to be like this. I want to. But to be honest with you, I'm still learning how not to worry. I'm still learning how not to fear, how not to live my life in self-sufficiency, to not live and think in pride. I'm still learning how to trust God more. I'm still learning how to submit to God's control over my life. I am still learning this morning how to hope in God. How to trust Him. Makes sense to me when I read Spurgeon's notes on Psalm 131. He said of this psalm, it's one of the shortest psalms to read, but one of the longest to learn. It's a psalm of David. It's an experiential psalm. David, in other words, is telling us by his own experience how it is that he learned to put his hope in God. How it was that God taught him to calm and quiet his soul in the presence of God. You see, this is a great psalm for a lot of us. It's a great psalm for the strong among us. Those who consider themselves type A personalities, power people, if you will. Those used to calling the shots in life, whether it be at work or at home or wherever that may be. You're used to being in charge and control. You're a strong person. This is a great psalm for you. It's a great psalm for the successful, particularly the self-made person. Those who rely on their talents. They rely on their accomplishments. They rely on their education and intellect to get them where they want to be in life. They're successful in measure of those matters. It's a great psalm for the scared among us. Those who are anxious today, fearful, maybe even frantic because you're not able to manage your life now the way you want to manage it. Things seem to be out of control, and because they are out of control, you're a little anxious from day to day about it all. This is a great psalm for you. It's a great psalm for the suffering. Those who are hurting today, but not just hurting, not just suffering. This is a great psalm for you because many of us who do hurt and do suffer, we preoccupy ourselves with finding out, what is God doing? What is God up to in my life? And not only that, why is He doing it? Why is He allowing this? Why did He take that away? This is a great psalm, essentially, for all of us, no matter where we find ourselves today. I've given us three headers there in your notes, and here's the first header, and it actually begins at the bottom. I know this is a little unusual to our format of studying through the Scriptures. We would normally look at verse 1, and then verse 2, and then verse 3, but I think it's important for this psalm that we go ahead and get to verse 3 and understand what David's objective is for us. And so here's the first header, and it fits over verse 3, and it's simply this: hope in the Lord. Hope in the Lord. This is David's objective for us here. And actually, this is what he is calling Israel to do. He's saying, oh Israel. He's addressing this to Israel in verse 3. Not the whole psalm, but particularly verse 3. Verse 3, oh Israel, hope in the Lord. This is what David desires for us. Not just Israel, but for us, the church, the people of God. Hope in the Lord. This is where we are to arrive, that we will put our hope in the Lord. Look at it in verse 3. That we'll put our hope in the Lord now, henceforth, and forever. Hope in the Lord. I'm still learning this. How to hope in the Lord. What does it mean to hope in the Lord? To hope is to put your confidence in God. To trust in Him. Believing that He will keep His promises. It means to rest in Him, to rely on God's love for us and God's care for us, assuring our hearts that He is working His good and His glory in every aspect of our lives. To hope in God is to wait on Him. That's the hard part, isn't it? It's to wait on Him, knowing with conviction that He is faithful, and He is faithful to us, and He has not forgotten me. This is what it means to hope in the Lord. When I read Psalm 131, I'm immediately drawn to the connection that's made in Psalm 130. In fact, we see the same message, really. Look at verse 7 of Psalm 130. He says, let Israel hope in the Lord. Hope in the Lord. It's the same thing he's telling us in Psalm 131 with a slight difference. In Psalm 130, he actually tells us what it looks like to hope in the Lord. Look at verse 5 of Psalm 130. I will wait for the Lord. My soul does hope or does wait, and in His word do I hope. So what does it look like to hope in the Lord? It's to hope in His word, verse 5 of Psalm 130. Verse 7, it's the hope in His loving kindness. Let Israel hope in the Lord, for with the Lord there is mercy. That word mercy, again, we mentioned this last Sunday. Anytime you see the word mercy, particularly in the Old Testament, it is the loving kindness of God. His loving kindness. And again, he says we will hope in the Lord, for the Lord there is mercy, and with Him there is abundant, plenteous redemption, that is His forgiveness. And so what Psalm 130 is telling us is what it looks like to hope in the Lord. That means I'm hoping in His word. I am hoping in His loving kindness over my life. I am hoping in His forgiveness in my life. That as his child. He is not judging me, for he has already judged me in Christ. No, he has forgiven me, and he loves me no matter what. And so in him and in his word, I will put my confidence. In his word, I will put my trust. In his word, I will wait. So when we come to Psalm 131, we see our need for a calm and quiet soul. That's what he says in verse 2. How that we need to calm and quiet our souls. And to do so, we have to commit ourselves again to hope in the Lord and in the gifts that he has graciously given us. The gift of his word, the gift of his loving kindness, the gift of his forgiveness. This is David's objective for us. It's what God has taught him to do, to hope in him. And it's what he wants us also to learn, how you and I can put our hope in the Lord. And let me say, it's something that God does in our life. God is the one who comes alongside of us and takes us through life experiences where we find that our hope can be deepened and our faith can be strengthened. And sometimes, Christian, these things can never be learned in any other way but by the Lord taking us through them. We cannot learn these things in a classroom alone. We cannot learn these things just by reading books about them. No, sometimes God says, I have to do something in your life in order for you to learn how to hope in me more than you've ever hoped in me. To trust in me more than you've ever trusted in me. So God does this. And that's David's testimony here. He's turning in verse 3 to Israel, and he's saying to Israel, as I am saying to us, hope in the Lord. And then when we get back to verse number 1, we see the testimony of how God took him through an experience that strengthened his hope. And that's the next header, because David tells us how we are to hope in God. And it's a transformational journey. It's a move where God takes us from something to something. And particularly in this case, in David's story, and that's the next header, write down number 2. It's a move from pride to humility. From pride to humility. And we see this in verse 1. Lord, my heart, David says, it is not haughty, it is not proud, nor my eyes lofty. They are not lifted up. Neither do I concern or preoccupy myself in matters that are too great for me, or things too profound, things too deep, things too high for me. There's a move here. A move has taken place in David's life. A move away from pride to humility. It's actually a great series of statements in verse 1, isn't it? My heart is not proud. My eyes are not lifted up. Neither do I concern my entire being with things that are too great for me. This entire move that God has made in his life from pride to humility, it has affected his heart. It has affected his eyes. It's affected his entire being. In verse 1, David is renouncing pride and presumption. He's renouncing arrogance and ambition. The idea here is not allowing ourselves to rise to where God is. He says, my heart is not going to be proud. My eyes are not going to be lifted up. My being is not going to involve myself into the place where God is. And where is God? Well, God is sovereign. God is in control. Church, God is on the throne, not you. Not me. I'm not sovereign. I'm not in control. I'm not on the throne. God is. And that's what David is making clear here. He's saying, I will not compete with God. I will not become a rival to Him. Therefore, my heart is not proud and my eyes are not lifted up, and I am refusing to involve myself in things that only God is responsible for. Now, this is different from Psalm 121. Do you remember Psalm 121:1? David again said, I will lift up mine eyes unto the hills. From where does my help come from? Now, Psalm 121, the idea of David lifting his eyes up there to God, he is doing it from a posture of humility, trust, dependence. I'm in a struggle, David says. I'm not going to lift my eyes up and fight the struggle myself. No, I'm going to lift up my eyes because it is from God my help comes. It is on Him I depend. Psalm 131 is different. When he says, I will not lift up my eyes in Psalm 131, it's about really lifting up ourselves. Seeking to involve ourselves in the ways of God that are simply too great for man. Look at it again in verse 3. I will not exercise or concern myself with great matters, with things that are too profound for man. What are those things that are too great for us? Now think about this. What are those things that are too profound? Well, there are the things that God is up to that are beyond our comprehension. It can be those things in our life that we experience that bring difficulty. They're painful. They're mysterious. Where did this come from? And why did it happen? And why is it happening now? And as we go through these things, no matter what they are, where are we left? We are left wondering, Lord, what in the world are you up to in my life? I can't make sense of it. I don't know why it's happening. I don't know what is going on. And it is here God says, these are the things that are too great for you. Too profound for you to understand. These are the higher ways of God. Too great to know. Too profound to understand. Deuteronomy 29:29. You don't have to turn there, but write it down in your notes and reflect on it later, because I think this will really help all of us here. Deuteronomy 29:29 says this, the secret things belong to the Lord our God. But, Moses says, those things which are revealed belong to us and to our children forever, that we may do all the words of His law. So he gives us two aspects of the will of God. There is the revealed things of God, His will that is revealed to us, that which He has clearly told us. And where do we find that? Oh, we find that in His Word. This is the revealed Word of God. This is his revealed will for us. Things that he wants us to know about him. Things that he wants us to know about ourselves. The revealed things are given to us. That's why it's important that we live in the Word. Because as we seek to discern what is the will of God for my life, when we open up the pages of his word and we find that everything his will wants us to know is right here. And the things that he doesn't want us to know is not here. That is the secret things of God. The secret things of God is his will, yes, but it is his will that he has not revealed. It is the will of God and the work of God that he doesn't allow me and you to look into and see. The will that he's trying to accomplish. The will of why we are suffering. The will of why he hasn't answered a specific prayer that we have prayed forever for. Those are the secret things that are to be left to God. The things that he says to us, this is not of your concern as to why. And those things could be many things, right? Let's be honest. This applies in many different areas. Perhaps for the young couple, it's the longing for a child that hasn't yet come. Perhaps for the single, it's the desire to be married that is not yet fulfilled. It could be that prayer that we've been praying for healing and deliverance that hasn't yet been answered. Those are the secret things. And this is what David is saying. I will not concern myself with the secret things of God. I am not going to allow my mind to be distracted, to be tempted to move away from God just because I can't make sense of why these things that are secret to God but unrevealed to me, that I don't know the answer to. And David is content with that. And you know why he's content with that? Verse 3. Because he has found himself to hope in the Lord. Again, I'm learning this. This is not something that's been checked off of my life as a spiritual achievement. Well, in this year, on that day, I accomplished that. Now on to the next thing. No, I don't know that I ever will. Other than to tell you, I'm still learning, because I think what David is showing us here is what I needed to see. This is a daily battle. It's a real struggle not to involve ourselves in the things that are left only to God. It's a real struggle in our lives to let God be God alone. Not to take control. Not to fret when we're not in control. To focus on the revealed things and to leave the secret things to him. Now think about this. Spurgeon said, a man does well to know his own size. Really think about that. We do well to know our own size. Now, I'll just say that's good advice in many areas, not just the secret things of God, right? If you're going to pick a fight with somebody, it do you well to know your own size before you pick that fight. I mean, how foolish would it be of me to go on the job site where Dell is tomorrow, put my hard hat on, walk into that development, and start telling Dale how to do his job. Dale's world is not my world. I don't know how to build a house. I don't know how to get it up to code. I don't know how to bring it into inspection. I don't know how to run a crew to make sure the work gets done. I can barely hold a hammer. So it does me well when I'm with Dale to know my own size in comparison to him. In that world, he is so much bigger than me. I have no comprehension of it. The same is true sometimes with others. They'll try to get in theological debates with me. It would do all of us well to know our own world. But this world in which you live in, it is not ours. It is God's. He spoke it into existence. He created it. He is sustaining it. This life that you live does not belong to you. It belongs to God, and it would do all of us well to know our own size. Who am I to tell him how to run his world? Now think about this with David. Now, I know some of you think we're never going to get back to 1 Samuel, and I'm not sure that we're ever going to get back there either. And I'm really bummed about that because I was doing a 3-part series on our journey through 1 Samuel. We were in chapter 17. We were looking at David and Goliath, and we were really getting to the heart of it. And then it was right after sermon number 2 that I had my collapse. And I will one day, we'll get to sermon 3. It might be a year from now, but we'll eventually get there. But when we do get there, if you don't know this already, you will learn that from the moment that Samuel told David that God had chosen him to be the new king of Israel, do you know how long it was before he actually sat on the throne? 10 years. 10 years. Think of that. 10 years of waiting. And by the way, he had many opportunities to take Saul out, to jump ahead of God, to claim the throne for himself. Instead, what did he do? He waited. And he learned not to concern himself with things that were too great for him. Things that were left only for God to do. And how many times in our life, in pride, do we try to hurry God along when it is not the will of God? How many times in our life has God laid something on our heart? He has given us a vision through His Word to accomplish His purposes, and we want it to happen now, and God doesn't want it to happen now. It is then, friend, we learn to wait on God. We learn to hope in Him. We look up and say, I will not allow my heart to be haughty. I will not lift my eyes up to rival you. And I will not concern myself with things that are too great for me. That whole scene of David is the opposite of pride, isn't it? A quote from Tim Keller. Tim Keller is a wonderful author. You should read after him. He says, spiritual pride, listen carefully, spiritual pride is the illusion that we are competent to run our own lives, achieve our own self-worth, and find a purpose big enough to give us meaning in life without God. I'm going to read that again. Spiritual pride is the illusion that we are competent to run our own lives, achieve our own sense of self-worth, and find a purpose big enough to give us meaning in life without God. That's spiritual pride. It is the opposite of Psalm 131. And when we try to run our own lives, when we try to find our own self-worth, when we try to find meaning in this life outside of God, pride takes over and our hearts become haughty and our eyes are lifted up and we begin to concern ourselves with trying to be a God over our own life. That's essentially what pride is. Pride says, you're not God, I'm God. No wonder James tells us that God rejects the proud, but he gives grace to the humble. You know why God rejects the proud? Because pride rivals his glory. And how many times have we learned in the Bible that God will not share his glory with anyone? So how did David get to the point where he hopes in the Lord? God had to take him on a journey. He had to move him from pride to humility, for it is the humble heart that hopes in the Lord. The proud heart hopes in himself, but the humble heart hopes in the Lord. The third header that I want to show you, and this is in verse number 2, is simply a calm and quieted soul. A calm and quieted soul. Verse 2, surely, David says, I have, some of your translations will say behaved, a better understanding of that is calmed. Surely I have calmed and quieted myself. As a child that is weaned of his mother, my soul is even as a weaned child. I would think most of us who are of age in the room this morning understand what a weaned child is. A weaned child is one who is no longer nursing. And on the surface, at least for me, this seems rather odd. That it is the weaned child that is calm and quiet. Does that not strike at least some of you odd? Because when I think of the child who's nursing, I think of the fact that, you know, when the child is attached to mom, it finally, you know, it's quiet. But it's not the weaning child so much as it is the weaned child. And here's how I make sense of what David is saying. Because the child not yet weaned embraces their mother for what they can immediately get from her. They're not so much calm just to be with her. They want food. And they're going to cry and complain and whine and get red in the face and all of that until they get the food and nourishment that they need. That's the child not weaned. It comes to its mother in that regard for the sole purpose of getting what I need. The weaned child is different. The weaned child is calmed and quieted. Watch this. Not by what the mother gives in terms of need. No, the weaned child is calmed and quieted by the presence of the mother herself. Again, I go to Tim Keller. I could try to explain it to you, or I can just quote somebody who will explain it better. He says, a nursing child held by its mother is highly aware of the milk she can offer and will squirm and cry if denied. But a child who has been weaned and no longer nurses is content just to be with its mother, enjoying her closeness and love without wanting anything else. This is why some of the sweetest moments for a mother, and moms, you understand this, is when a weaned child will crawl up onto her lap, cuddle up next to her shoulder, lay her head down, and do so simply out of desire to rest in the lap of her presence. Why? Because the child has learned to love his mother not for what he can get from her, but for who she is to him. That's mom. And when I'm with mom, she loves me and she cares for me, and she's reliable, and she is faithful. He has learned not to go to her just for needs. He has learned to go to her because he wants to be with her. I find this too awkwardly clear in our own home. That whenever our kids are hurt, they don't want me, they want mom. Occasionally, I'll get that nice snuggle where Ellie will climb up in my lap and there and lay her head on my shoulder. And I think, this is wonderful, but it's usually her. I mean, even our dog does that. Our dog and I, we have a unique relationship. You know, he'll greet me in the morning, but when it comes time for snuggling or whatever, it's her all the way. In fact, just the other day, I'd stepped outside, Kathleen was away, and I'd stepped into the garage, and he understands the noises of the garage to be when the kids or us come home. And so I went out to the garage. I don't know if I was cutting grass or what, but I was out there for a while. But when I went to shut the garage door, that's his noise. He knows something's happening. Somebody's coming inside. Kathleen's not around. I come through the garage. I open up the door. I walk in, and he's so excited, he jumps, and then he sees it's me, and his ears go down, and he turns and walks away like that. I told Kathleen, he thought it was you. This is what David has learned. He is weaned from himself to God. He has been weaned from pride to humility. He has been weaned from being concerned with things too great for him to leaving those things with the Lord. And now he says, I have calmed and quieted my soul, and I have done so like a weaned child. Think about the process of weaning. Some of you moms don't want to go back there, but it's painful. There's resistance, there's frustration, there's tears, there's tantrums. Sometimes even the mom has those same results. It's hard to go through an experience in life where you are being broken. Isn't that what we're doing when we wean a child? We're breaking them. It's hard to go through life experiences where God breaks us. And that's exactly what God does when he weans us from something. Whether he's weaning us from ourselves or from pride or whatever, God is breaking us. And when God does that, it's uncomfortable. That's why often in that season, we want to go back to how it was. Because God's work right now in our lives, in the immediate, it's painful, it's difficult, this stinks. Which helps us to understand how it is that God weans us. So often he weans us through trial and suffering. Are you listening to me, Christian? The suffering that we're going through is because God is trying to wean us from something. It's his process of taking away from us the things that we have relied on, hoped in, had ambitions for, in order that we might learn to hope in him alone, with a calm and quiet soul. We're all a work in progress, aren't we? All of us. God has promised that he will finish this construction zone that he's got going on in my life. But he's still working. And he's still working in his own ways. And while he's still working, guess what? I'm still learning. And I'm sure that even for many of us sitting here today, that our souls are maybe not all that calm. Maybe not all that quiet. We're agitated. Let's get real for a minute. You're agitated. You get agitated all day. You get agitated at everything. You're frustrated. You're discontented. I think that's a big thing that God has to teach us when he begins to wean us, is finding contentment with who we are and where he has put us. But some of our souls are discontent with who we are and where he has put us. Some of us are disappointed, even distressed. But listen to me this morning. There's only one way for our souls to get calm. There's only one way for our souls to get quiet. And again, I'm still learning this. It's by humbling ourselves and learning to hope in God. Not for what we can get from him, but for God himself. To say, God, you are enough. You are enough, God. I don't have to have this. I don't have to be here. Lord, you are all that I need. And sometimes there's a lot of breaking he has to do to get us to the place where we truly in life say, I don't have to have any of this. I just want you. What is God weaning you from today? Spurgeon. Y'all ever heard of him before? I like him. Blessed, listen carefully, Spurgeon, blessed are those afflictions which subdue our affections, which wean us from self-sufficiency, which educate us into Christian maturity, which teach us to love God, not only when he comforts us, but even when he tries us. Most often we are given the picture of God as our Father, and he is as the first person of the Trinity, God the Father. But there are certain images that are scattered along the way that show us what David was trying to say here about the mother's relationship with the child. Another location is Isaiah 66. Verse 13, in speaking of how a mom comforts her child by her mere presence, so God does the same for us. Listen to what he says in Isaiah 66:13. As one whom his mother comforts, God says, so I will comfort you. God is enough. Do you believe that? If you don't believe that, then ask God today and tomorrow. Show me what you want me to know so that I can believe in my heart that you are enough. Calm your soul today. Quiet yourself in him. Fix your hope in the Lord. I'm still learning this, church. And chances are, you are too. That's the beauty of the church. Is we get to come together and learn together how to hope in God together. I stand together.